Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks so much for being with us. And I can say Merry Christmas because it's still the Christmas season. So Merry Christmas to you and all of yours. Today we continue what we started in our last program with a review of the events of the year from a Catholic perspective. And that means some of the things we'll talk about as important stories you may not have heard reported as important stories, but they are I guess one way we might say it is we can't always rely on the secular media to make good choices about what's important. And some very important things did happen this year that were reported there and some that were not. And so we'll cover both of those. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and I'm joined in studio with just two of my favorite people because I don't have to even think when they are there. There's so much brain power in the room. I don't even have to think a little bit. First up, our chaplain, Father Hugh Barber, Norbertine
priest.
Are you
a bearer of little brain?
A bearer of what?
A bearer of little brain.
Is that what Pooh is?
Winnie the Pooh.
Right. Winnie the Pooh. Yes, I am. I live under the name of Sanders.
Okay.
Now, you really got to like Winnie the Pooh to know what that means, live under the name of Sanders.
Yeah, I understand it perfectly.
Hello, Father, by the way, Father Hugh Barber.
Hello.
Also joining us in studio, our president, Christopher Check. Hi, Chris.
Merry Christmas, Cy.
Merry Christmas.
Cy, and I know that we're going to talk about the great and not-so-great things that happened in 2019, but I have to announce – or in 2018, as you were.
Please.
Right.
Yes.
If we do 2019 –
well, Father Hugh –
unless you're a prophet.
Father Hugh –
unless you're going to tell us about the future.
Father Hugh is here, so, you know –
Can you see the future, Father?
Yeah. But something great happened in 2018, in fact, just a few days ago, and it was the agreement from Father Hugh's superior, Abbot Eugene Hayes of St. Michael's Abbey, that Father Hugh will be our chaplain for the next 3 years, at least.
3 years?
Yes.
Holy smokes, I've been so worried. Yay, we get Father. That's wonderful.
So praise God. I know there's. Yeah. I know everyone out in Catholic Answers Live land is rejoicing. There's feasting and rejoicing in Jerusalem next year.
Yeah. And so apostolate is not one that just rips through chaplains. This is good. We have some stability in the party. I mean, Father Serpent was here, what, 17 years or something?
Yes.
And now
– there you go.
There's
so
your goal,
you
Father.
Got me
for at least
three more
four.
Years. That will be four altogether.
Four so altogether.
We'll see. But I will see. But let's just say great, happy.
Very, very
all
good.
Threes are perfect.
Oh, yeah. Three is the perfect number.
But you look, and there's three of us sitting here.
There's three, nine, 12, 15, you know, it keeps going, you know.
Yeah.
You just have to add by threes, that's all.
Here's the way we'll do this for this hour. I've got you for 2 hours. We'll see if this works. I'm going to throw out things that happened. If you don't want to talk
forever,
about them.
I'm here all day
I know,
long.
I know, and you don't mind sitting here in front of a microphone because you like talking, Father, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I like to hear myself talk. It's true.
So. Well, that's good because
everyone
we all like to hear you
Catholic
talk.
Catholic Answers likes to hear you talk, Father. Everyone listening to the radio.
Well, how kind.
I'm going to start off with some edifying news. I think it's edifying. I guess I should get your opinions about it. But in the first half of the year, Pope Francis made clear that he would canonize Pope Paul VI and Archbishop Oscar Romero. In the second half of the year, he made good on that. So maybe let's start with because I think we may have more expansive comments on Pope Paul VI. I want to start with Oscar Romero. Were you aware that he had been made a saint?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. Okay, good. I'm so glad to hear that you're keeping up on those things. Is it controversial?
It's controversial because of the misrepresentation of the man.
Yeah. Is that right? Okay. Yeah. So can you help me with that?
He was not a leftist.
No. He was routinely accused by the right and even people on the sort of the neocon Catholic right especially of being a proponent of liberation theology. Which he was not.
No, that really is a slander. He was not a liberation.
No, he actually when he was appointed archbishop, all of the right-wingers in El Salvador, they were happy.
Yes, right.
Said, oh, great.
Yeah, no, the left did not like him.
The left did not like him.
Right, because he was a Catholic.
He's an ecclesiastic. You know, he's a priest, a bishop, a churchman. And so, but when he began to perceive, when he did his diocesan visitations and he saw what was actually going on and how the poor were being treated and the political situation, he had to speak out. And, of course, the right-wingers that were supported by our government, they wanted a bishop who would not say anything against them. not challenge them in the least.
Right. And the church is neither right wing nor left wing.
Right, exactly.
No, she's the guardian of the truth.
We're guarding the truth and of true justice. And he was an upright man who simply spoke out for the interests of those who were oppressed,
He was very devout. He had a great devotion to Our Lady. I think his biographer makes the point that, sure, the liberation theologians, if you will, would come by and bring their books for him to read. And his biographer, whose name has escaped me just now, says, when I went through his library after his death, I found that he had never even opened any of these books. But the books that were well-worn were the church fathers.
Yeah.
Yeah, so right.
He was a good pastor.
And a great friend of Opus Dei, by the way. I think the night before he was martyred in a hospital chapel. Right.
He had an evening mass on a Sunday in a hospital chapel.
Yeah, but the evening before he had been at an evening recollection or something with Opus Dei.
Yeah, yeah.
Now let me just pause.
Who are hardly accused of being left wing.
No.
Those left wing Opus Dei people. But let me just pause real quickly to ask about that word martyr. You say he was martyred. I want to know what the word means. Is that correct to say that he's martyred?
Do we call him a confessor or a martyr? I don't know.
No, he's a martyr because he was canonized as a martyr, I think. For sure, or beatified. Because he was killed in hatred of the faith, and I mean he was shot dead at the altar.
I mean, really
like
hard.
Like Thomas Becket, that you could say Thomas Becket might not satisfy certain Baroque qualifications for martyrdom because the king was a Catholic. He was a Catholic. He wasn't being killed because he was a Catholic. It was because he was inconvenient for the king.
Yeah.
But he was killed because he was doing his job.
As a
Catholic prelate.
Yeah.
And so the same with Romero.
So
we can't be too narrow about these things.
This is exactly the point.
Thank you.
An organization that is in part Catholic Answers dedicated to precision on certain questions. I think this one of martyr is something that we can get. Like, for example, that French priest from 2 years ago.
He was killed in hatred of the faith.
Yeah, clearly. Exactly. Yep.
Clearly.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think, didn't the Pope wear red when he canonized Maximilian Kolbe?
Maximilian Kolbe was first beatified as a confessor.
Okay.
Because they were going by the standards, the 18th century standards that they had.
Right.
And since he wasn't killed explicitly because he was a priest, but because he offered his life for somebody else, they said, well, he's not exactly a martyr. Well, this is a failure of imagination.
That certainly seems like a failure of imagination.
As you tend to say, manca non la fantasia.
We're really towing to the letter of the law.
And so don't call Pope John Paul, when he canonized him, he was canonized as a martyr.
You know, someone who is very dear to you and me, Joan of Arc, is referred to as a martyr, but strictly she's a confessor.
She's a virgin, just a virgin.
Right, yeah.
The confessor is only used for men.
Oh, okay, virgin then.
Yeah. She's a virgin.
But who's going to not say Joan of Arc is a martyr?
She wasn't killed in hatred of the faith.
No, I mean, by the standards of the time, she was the victim of
political.
I mean, she's a clearer case where the real issue is political. She was on the wrong side of a political battle.
Fair enough.
And
killed by the English, by French puppets of the English.
Yeah, and who tried to trick her? But what a little
ignore that.
What a holy genius!
Oh, I'm sorry, they weren't English, Father.
Let's not pick on the English nor the French. All will be united.
The Irish had nothing to do with it.
Absolutely,
the Irish had nothing. For once, we can't blame the Irish. Good. But I do want to say this about Romero. It's important to note that saints are not necessarily people who are proponents of American foreign policy. And I don't.
Is that a fact?
Yeah.
Imagine.
Yeah,
well, let's see who might be in that list, like Saint Paul the Sixth and Saint
Pope John Paul the Second,
Pope John Paul II,
one day Benedict the Sixteenth, perhaps, yeah,
right. So
and whatever they say on certain Catholic networks, you know. The church has not supported our foreign policy.
But I find that fact bracing for this reason, that we can mix politics, and because politics is essentially wrestling over morals, we can easily get drawn into thinking that politics and religion are the same thing, and that and mixing them up. That certainly happens in the United States among a large part of the Protestant population in the United States. There's a kind of deifying of America.
Sure.
But as a Catholic, we have to not do that because, no, because we would miss a saint like Romero if we did that.
Well, the problem is that
or a Dorothy Day, for example.
Exactly right. Who was, you know, she committed the unbelievable sin of being opposed to our entry into World War II, but not because she was a philo-Nazi, because she just didn't believe in what
war.
We were doing and siding with, you know, and she would have known, you know, what it meant to be allied with Stalin. You know, she had commie friends. But the what you have to consider is that for Catholics, we have a visible church.
Okay.
And that includes everyone in the Catholic Church.
Right.
Everyone.
Even those who are inconvenient to America.
Even those who are inconvenient to America. All these little Latin American types, all the people marching up the road, you know, coming to like assail our borders. And I'm not commenting on that whole issue because it's clear that they're being misled, but that's another question.
Right, but they are our brothers and sisters in the
faith. Exactly, absolutely.
Right.
And they're praying to the Blessed Mother and to the saints to make them safe and take care of their families and all that. And that's the important thing. But with Protestantism, especially the evangelical sort, there's no visible church. And so consequently, the visible church ends up being America and Israel, basically.
Yeah, I see.
Like there's the people of the Old Covenant, and then there's the shining light on the hill, America. And they don't have any notion of a visible church, so it's replaced by political
entities. Visible churches.
By political
right,
entities.
Those who are with us.
Political entities.
I have
right.
a question for Father Hugh on that very point. I understand how Americans see the world this way, including many American Catholics. But how much does that view influence the understanding of the church of, say, the Frenchman or the Italian or the Spaniard? Are they overcome by it, at least to some degree?
Well, only by way of a certain necessary sympathy, given the current state of affairs. Like you'll notice that with European Catholic websites, that they know that a vigorous Orthodox Catholicism is stronger in the States than it is there.
Sure, homeschooling, for example, thrives here in the United States in ways.
And so, consequently, they admire what we're doing, but they also have a cultural and political perspective which is much more refined or nuanced
than
ours.
I would say thorough.
Yeah, thorough, right.
Yeah,
right. Nuanced than ours. But and so
well, they've had a lot of time.
Yeah, but it's an interesting – if you consider like the EU, which is now the proponent of all kinds of progressive notions all over Europe.
Right.
Originally, it was a Catholic Habsburg project to unite Europe – overcome the disaster of World War I and get Europe under a polity that was sound. Yeah. And, of course, then it was hijacked. It's like the UN. The UN was the same way, League of Nations.
Well,
they had really good initial beginnings and then
– it's kind of a Tower of Babel now. It's we'll be united but with no God above us.
No, definitely.
And that's a very serious problem.
Right, very serious problem.
I'm glad to hear you mention French Catholics because there are many who have the idea that the French, there are no more French Catholics, but there is a little bit of a revival among French Catholics.
Well, you know, but what was it about a year ago or more? How many hundreds of thousands turned out in the streets of.
To defend marriage.
Yeah, right, the streets of Paris.
Practically a million.
Yeah, and then also.
And from the right and the left, both.
And then, as you're right, particularly among those who are devoted to traditional liturgy, that Chartres pilgrimage that takes place every year attracts thousands.
Well, I'm glad we got to cover Romero, and we're blessed as a church. That's what we should remember. We are blessed as a church by a new saint. And
my son Nicholas was thrilled when
Romero became a saint.
Right, yeah. And you can hear. I mean, on NPR, if you excuse me, they covered.
You know, there's Catholic radio. You don't have to listen to
Father
NPR.
Listens to NPR.
No, sorry, excuse me. But I mean, they covered. They had a whole thing because, of course, that he's chic, so they'll cover him. You
right.
know? And but what's that?
No tapping.
Oh, that's me. That's for me. That's not for him.
I'm not the only one. Anyway,
you're not even the main one.
No, you were like tapping like crazy. Anyway, but they had a great show from the journalist who was at his mass in that hospital chapel.
Oh,
covering the mass for the newspaper, and she was present and she was recording the whole thing, and so you can hear his martyrdom.
Oh, wow.
It's quite moving.
It reminds one of the film of Miguel Pro, that crazy film of Miguel Pro. But I guess that's modern martyrdom.
We have this to take one, you can actually hear it. Yeah.
We have to take a break. We still have our Christmas sale going. And you're like, what? Christmas is over. No, it's not. You're a Catholic. Well, if you're not, you can be. But because we celebrate Christmas, we just keep it going.
Through February sometime.
But the sale doesn't go all the way.
Through February 2nd. Yeah.
till Candlemas.
Right.
Now usually people will say at least until the 6th of January because that's the Feast of the Epiphany.
No, or the baptism.
Don't be mad at people who love the Epiphany, Father.
I'm not mad at them. I'm just saying.
I got to read this copy, though.
Okay.
I apologize for starting an argument with you just as I'm supposed to be reading copy. You can still save money on hundreds of items in our online shop until midnight Monday. Enter CALIVE18 at checkout when you visit shop.catholic.com and save 30% off hundreds of books, DVDs, CDs, and other stuff in our online store. Sale pricing must end Monday at midnight. I don't know why it says must end. Possibly it's a legal thing. I don't know. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more review of the year from a Catholic perspective with Father Hugh Barber and Chris Check right after this.
This is Bishop Chad Zielinski from the Diocese of Fairbanks of Northern Alaska, and you are listening to Catholic Answers Live.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
I would describe myself as a revert, and ever since I came back to a practice of my faith, I started praying the rosary, going to even daily mass, God has led me on an amazing journey and used me in a lot of incredible ways that I never dreamed would have been possible, and I'm just so grateful to God for all of his gifts and blessings in my life.
Take Two with Jerry and Debbie, tomorrow, noon Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're doing a bit of a year in review. We're working our way through the second half of the year. Actually, we're going to talk about whatever we want to talk about, but we'll try. We'll connect it to the happenings of the year 2018 from a Catholic perspective. Our chaplain, Father Hugh Barber, and our president, Christopher Check, are our guests this hour. We were talking about the two ordinations. The Romero and Paul VI.
Canonization.
They were both ordained as well, but that's not what we were discussing.
Yeah, a little bit earlier, yeah.
Two canonizations. So we've covered Archbishop Romero, Pope Paul VI.
Paul VI is a very fascinating figure who connects the arc of the history of the Church from the 30s until his death in 78, and with the council and everything else. And I had the good fortune of hearing his confessor, who
– I thought he was going to say I had the good fortune of hearing his confession.
His
confessor. No, you can talk in general terms, and his confessor did.
Oh, really?
So his confessor was Paolo Dezza.
Paolo
Dezza was the
he's been on the show.
The venerable old Jesuit that
he has not.
That JP2 put in charge of the Jesuits when he tried to bring them into line.
Uh-huh.
And so he said, you can't elect a new superior general. I'm just imposing Paolo Dezza. And he taught metaphysics to my founding abbot, so I always felt a certain affinity for him because I met him a few times. But I asked him about Paul VI, and he said and it's since been quoted in the media, so he must have said a lot. He said, because he was a confessor, he said he wasn't a saint when he became pope, but he was.
Wow. At the end. Wow, that's extraordinary. And he was pope from what? He was pope from 64 or 63 to 78?
63 to 78.
63 to 78. I imagine that he's probably not the only guy who the papacy brought. So, I mean, it didn't do it for all of them, but it – And I wonder, Father, if the fact that from 1963 to 1978, every Catholic on the earth on Sunday prayed for him. Do you think that that actually helps a little bit with this personal
sanctity? Well, I think that what happened was that everything was running smoothly and the world loved him until 1968. And when Humanae Vitae came out, he was abandoned by the hierarchies of England, France, Belgium,
Canada,
Germany, Canada, not the United States.
Entirely.
Not entirely.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
But
no,
just
the professors at Catholic University.
Right, of course. And then Cardinal Boyle suspended all of them. Yeah. And then the Vatican made him reinstate them. It was really sad. But any
so case, his crucible, his
crucible was that.
Was Humanae Vitae.
Because he, and then at that point, his only friends, at least on the Italian peninsula, were the people that had always opposed him.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's a very difficult thing to bear.
All right. Well, cannot talk about Paul VI without going in depth about Humanae Vitae. I want to do that, but before we do that,
he wrote seven encyclicals.
But that's what.
But more important,
him also. I mean, think about priestly celibacy.
Yep. Devotion to the Virgin,
Devotion to Blessed Mother,
evangelization,
and then Mysterium Fidei, which people always forget, the doctrine of the Eucharist, where he vindicates Eucharistic adoration and private Mass. Like Mass without people there.
But this you all are bypassing what I wanted to get to.
He's the author of a social justice encyclical capitalists hate.
Yep. Yeah.
He's the Pope of the Council. I mean, we always think of John the 23rd as the Pope of the Council, but John died the first year of the Council. A new Pope does not have to persist with the Council. He can say, well, let's digest that and we'll move on. And he led the Council through – very, very, very important discussions in was it to be 64 and 65?
That he really and truly, providentially was able to kind of hold it all together.
Yeah.
Even though he was he was not beloved by left to right at the end of the whole thing. And so he really was, suffered a lot and was isolated. And at the end of his life, it was terrible for him. Because there's a whole Italian political crisis with the Red Brigades and
killing people put him in,
and just yeah. like and he was from a very very refined Italian Christian Democrat family and just saw it all falling apart in this madness.
The Montini family.
So right. how did he do as the Pope of the Great Modern Council?
Well, he's the Pope of the Second Vatican Council for sure.
Yeah.
What's interesting is that he was the right-hand man of Pius XII, and Pius XII didn't appoint a Secretary of State for his entire pontificate.
Oh.
Because he was Secretary of State when he was elected Pope, and he just kept the job.
And I can do that better than you.
Poor Pope Paul Montini was just the sostituto. He was the substitute. So he didn't ever have the title of Secretary of State,
mm-hmm.
but he was trained by Pius XII in diplomacy and all of that. And he faithfully carried out projects of Pius XII. And I know traditionalists will not like to hear this, but the Missa Normativa that we know now as the Novus Ordo, it was already clearly described in the liturgical conference of Assisi in 1958 under Pius XII. And you can see the whole thing lined out there. And if you look at his Holy Week Rite revision, you can see it's pretty much the same thing. Now, he might have been less radical than some of these people were after he died, because Pius XII didn't want a council. He just wanted to rule.
Just do it.
His opinion was, and I think Paul VI's opinion would have been also, but John the 23rd changed it all, was that because of modern life and modern media, it was not prudent to have a council because it would be manipulated. And I mean, that's
what happened.
That's exactly what happened.
Father, you tell this story, and I'm trying to a place where it is in the liturgical calendar, but Paul VI going to say a Mass, is it during the Easter season or something? You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah, yeah. When
discovering that these portions have been eliminated. So where are they?
No, it was actually because the new breviary, it comes to a screeching halt after Pentecost. There's no octave of Pentecost, which Pius XII had preserved. There was an octave of Christmas, and of Easter and of Pentecost. They got rid of all the other octaves to simplify things. But there was at least octave of Pentecost. So Paul VI in his chapel and Monsignor Martin, who is prefect of the pontifical household, a Frenchman, he's there and he has the breviary open in front of Paul VI to pray his office in the morning after Pentecost. And he looks at it and he says, "What did they do with the octave of Pentecost?" He said, "Well, Your Holiness, you abolished it." He said, "I did not know I had abolished it."
Yeah. Well, that's pretty sad. He was not well served.
Well, that was Bunini. Now, there's a great biography of Bunini now that's out that people would be good to read by Yves Chiron.
All right. Well, we do have to talk about Humanae Vitae, though, if we're going to
definitely
continue to talk about Paul VI. It's the mark of his it's the turning point of everything in his papacy and probably in his life, apparently.
It's his heroism. It's what made him a saint.
Take a quick break. We'll be back with our review of the year from a Catholic perspective right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
A generation ago, Christian parents didn't have to worry about how to explain transgenderism to their 9-year-old children or help their teenager deal with mockery at school for believing in traditional marriage. But today, as our culture decays, we have to know how to talk to our children about these issues. In Made This Way, How to Prepare Kids to Face Today's Tough Moral Issues, Layla Miller and Trent Horn give parents the crucial tools and techniques to form children with the understanding they need, appropriate to their age and maturity level, to meet the world's challenges. If we're not teaching our children how to understand tough moral issues, then the world will. Read Made This Way and learn how to give your kids a firm foundation on which to build a life of moral clarity and happiness. Order your copy of Made This Way today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or logging onto the shop at Catholic.com.
What is the Catholic form of marriage and why is it important? What factors may invalidate a marriage? What about the so-called exception clause for divorce in cases of adultery? In 20 Answers, Divorce and Remarriage, you'll find smart, solid answers to these questions and many more, helping you understand church teaching on the indissolubility of marriage while examining the pastoral and canonical realities for Catholics who wish to join together in marriage. 20 Answers Divorce and Remarriage is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com today and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
Monday on Mortal Life, the life you were meant to live.
We'll look at how the theology of the body can help you live a more abundant life.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're reviewing the year from a Catholic perspective with our chaplain, Father Hugh Barber, and our president, Christopher Check. We're in the midst of discussing two canonizations. You probably knew about them, but we're just exploring them a little bit more in depth. We covered Oscar Romero, Archbishop Oscar Romero, and we've talked a bit about Pope Paul VI, but we have not gotten to the nub of the issue, I suppose one would say, with Pope Paul VI, and that is 1968, the most vicious and celebrated year of the sexual revolution. It's those two things go together. It's the cruelest year of modern era in many ways, 1968 and all that. But along comes the Pope right in the midst of it and affirms the teaching of the Catholic Church about the meaning of human sexuality, particularly that about marriage and about the purposes of sex within marriage. Mm-hmm. And that artificial contraception contradicts the meaning of marriage. Have I kind of given it a good?
No, that's fine.
Yeah, it's very good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Of course,
you say 1968 is the flashpoint. Perhaps the groundwork has been laid for generations before.
Certainly, yes.
Every Christian denomination, everyone who called himself a Christian up until 1930, when the Lambeth Council, the Anglicans, first make this exception for the poor, right? So there's a eugenics quality there from the start.
Yeah.
But in America, my goodness, the Comstock laws, these were all the work of Protestants, not Catholics in America. Catholics weren't living in America in any significant way back when these things were happening.
No, the opposition to contraception was a universal Christian teaching.
Yeah. From
both Protestants and Catholics.
No, but I mean
up until 1930.
And dating from the very earliest years of the the Christian church.
Morality.
Yeah, right. It wouldn't have
– In fact, coming out in a future issue of – or in an issue of 2019 issue, I'm not sure when it will be of Catholic Answers magazine, will be Cardinal Burke's keynote address from our conference in which he traces, you know, I think from the second century or something.
Yeah,
all the way up into the present. But I call the date 1930 and I'm sure most of our listeners know this already, but the thing to contemplate here is the speed. Once the churches capitulate, and the Washington Post at the time, the Washington Post said this will sound – there was an editorial in the Washington Post that said this will sound the death knell of marriage. So the Washington Post
in 1930
or even 1929, because there was an American Council of Churches that was also looking at the question. And so – but from 1930 until 1968, I mean what's the math here?
38 years?
Yeah, two generations. And the speed with which the decay – from that moment until then, and then, of course, now, and I know we'll get to some of these things, but right. the rapidity, the pace of the swirl down, you know.
I never thought of it like that, Chris.
Because for a couple of centuries, right? Millennia, and now.
And now it's gone, and now.
And we are so deep into the abyss and so rapidly deep into it.
Right. Okay. So in
1930, and then by 1942, they're passing out condoms to GIs.
Well, they still do that.
Yeah, of course
right.
they do.
Yeah,
but the point is that there's just like what would have been regarded before as just totally unacceptable became.
Yeah, I mean, it's an admission on the part of the United States government. We know that our servicemen are going to make ill use of the local female population, so we're just going to do what we can to protect them from venereal disease or a so-called unwanted.
Well, one understands the motivation, but if that's their only motivation, but still, it just shows that things had gone completely.
And then from Humanae Vitae,
yeah.
To now, I mean, if you could give one criticism of Humanae Vitae, it would be that Paul VI's quite accurate predictions about what would become of marriage, you could say he didn't even foresee the world of lunacy in which we find ourselves now, that the world of transgenderism. I was just mentioning to you on the break now, I only learned recently that they don't even call it a sex change operation anymore. It's called gender affirmation surgery.
Can someone page George Orwell?
Yeah,
can we get a call into George Orwell?
No, I think 1984 is a brilliant book.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the great books ever written by an anti-Catholic. But
some of our best friends are anti-Catholics.
That's true. That really is true. So that's a very funny point.
By the way, Aldous Huxley as well. I mean, these guys, Huxley even in Brave New World, really predicts better than.
Than
Paul VI.
Yeah, so it's not like he can't see what's coming, but we don't want to see what we don't want to see, I suppose.
Yeah.
And the idea was, look, okay, there's been melting of these ancient Christian mores, this ancient Christian repression of sex and all blah, 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 blah in the 60s. So Paul VI is clearly going I suppose this raised an expectation in a way.
Well, and he's got the Rockefellers whispering in his ear saying, you know, the whole continent of Africa is going to become overpopulated, Your Holiness, unless you do something about
so
this. This burden will be on your conscience.
Yeah.
Right.
You know the history, Father. Well, I kind of think you probably know the history of just about everything. I don't know. If I ask you something about history, I keep finding out. Someday I'm going to ask you about the Aztec kings or something. But let's say in 1967 or so, would there have been general sense among Catholics that eventually this will loosen, or was it just among the intelligentsia? Was it just
No, already, because we had the same situation that we have now with the media. That is, the media had already taken complete control of the news about the council.
Yeah.
And taken complete control of John the 23rd's
Xavier Wren and that
commission,
kind of thing.
Right? Commission. Well, he's not the worst of them by any. At least it was a book, you know.
Uh-huh.
His commission to examine the question, not of contraception. The commission was to examine whether or not
the pill
the
was
estrogen
contraception.
Pill yeah. constituted contraception.
Oh, right?
There was
I
never
see. Thank
any
you for
question.
Clarifying that.
Never any question of contraception being acceptable, but the question was, can a woman regulate her cycles in such wise as to be able to, you know, conceive conveniently? And very important tomas, for example, Charles de Koninck, who is the, you know, model for modern tomas in this part of the world, especially is the spiritual guide of the founders of Thomas Aquinas College, for example. He had 13 kids, and he said, well, it seems to me legitimate to regulate cycles to use this medication.
Right.
And so he came out on the side of, yes, it's okay, but it's not contraception. That's what he thought. Well, of course, Paul VI was able to see with a deeper wisdom that in point of fact, it would be used.
That a pill that keeps you from getting pregnant is in fact contraception. Yeah,
exactly,
that's amazing.
Right. Basically.
He's a real scientist.
It's a natural substance that's aiding the body to establish. And the fact is there are legitimate uses for the estrogen
what are
pill
contraceptions yeah,
for
right.
women that have all kinds of other difficulties.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
though, like, they and in are, fact, it, even to maintain pregnancies, things like that. I mean, it's used for all kinds of legitimate purposes.
I think they're fewer than perhaps you might think. I think those guys at the Paul VI Institute, Hilgers, would say that there are some, but they're not.
But even,
many.
No,
they're not
even that if there's many. One yeah. woman but, who's suffering some disease
but,
and
well,
needs
John,
help,
John,
it's legitimate.
The inventor of the pill, a Catholic Irishman father.
Yeah.
Yeah. John, he believed he was doing a favor for women.
Yeah. Yeah.
And trying to help them regulate their cycles.
But the real issue was to decide on that point. And of course, then the media picked it up and made it sound like the church was about to change her teaching on contraception.
So that,
and that
does
created this expectation and this craziness. And
well,
then when
and then
Paul
you,
VI
and
came
then
down.
And then, of course, you had theologians on this side of the ocean, famously among them, Michael Novak, who contributed a chapter to a book that the title of which is either irreverent if not blasphemous, called Frequent If Not Daily Communion. And he's riffing off of an earlier encyclical by one of the Piuses, I can't recall, on frequent communion.
Pius X,
thank you. But he's saying that in fact the pill, because the threat of pregnancy, the fear, you know, and I put quotes around both of those, of pregnancy is not there, then couples will come together more frequently. And
this would be good for marriage.
Never in his life did he disavow this argument, by the way.
He's
gone now. Pray for him.
Now he knows the truth.
But it must be said, though, I mean, in fairness, for example, to the Tomas that you mentioned.
Fair to him. I mean, it was a reasonable
theologians
argument.
Theologians should make arguments and work these things out. But when the Holy See has spoken, the matter is settled. Did this Tomas?
Absolutely.
He
accepted the magisterium completely and became
and
great defenders.
That's the proper role of a theologian.
Exactly. Exactly. And he had his own arguments. They're a little embarrassed by it because, you know,
they got it wrong.
But he didn't do it with a spirit of contestation. In fact, he had the opposite attitude. So,
right. Okay. So I have to say, though, the Pope was Pope Paul VI then. Was he naive? Did he not know what the reaction would be? Was he poorly advised about what the reaction would be? Or did he just not care? Did he say, I just got to say this now?
What he did actually is he took the tiny commission that John the 23rd had put together, and then he expanded it to a ton of experts.
Okay.
And because he wanted more
broad
calls, right,
consultation.
And that because he saw where it was going, and they were all going to recommend that it's okay. And so he had this enormous group, like he added 60 people to it. And then he sat there and listened to their arguments. he himself, the
Pope,
like a Baroque period Pope, like with the controversy over actual grace between the Jesuits and Dominicans.
Yeah. He Everyone
sat there
make
and
your
listened
yeah.
to their arguments, and he basically at the end said, "I don't hear anything which calls into question the Church's perennial teaching," and he just that was it.
Yeah.
And it was just – he behaved like a pope.
It's funny because the caricature is he didn't listen to the commission. But the fact is he did listen to the commission then he did his job.
He made it even bigger to get more information. But also he didn't want to be stuck with just a small little group of people.
I have to say just in defense of my own parents and many other couples like them, the clergy who attacked Paul VI or refused to defend that teaching – abandoned many of the laity who they needed support, and what they got was criticism, what they got was marginalization, and for whatever reason my parents were, as many Catholic people were, they were going to do what the Pope told them to do. They're not rebels or something like that, but they had to put up with a lot, and I think this is an untold, maybe brushed aside part of the story that
harm that the American presbyterate did to marriage.
Yeah. And to people who were just trying to be good Catholics.
Right. But I mean, if a Catholic couple, say in LA, and I know several families like that, were determined to stay faithful to Church's teaching after 1968, they would have gotten zero support from their clergy.
Right.
They
had to do it on their own.
On the contrary, they would have been told it's okay. This, in fact, my wife Jacqueline comes from a family of six, and after the sixth, her priest told her, it's okay. You can use the pill if you want.
Well, that's what I mean by zero support. Yeah. Is that the priests were simply not interested in supporting the church's
teaching.
No,
actually, they were actively interested in dissenting and spreading dissent.
And this is not a matter of accompaniment, finding someone who needs time.
Accompaniment. Please, thank you very much. I think I'll go home by myself.
You know what I mean? Like, it's okay for a priest in the confessional, for example, to not raise issues with someone, to allow the person's time to develop their. And that you would think of that, that's just good pastoral care.
Right.
But this is the opposite. This is positively saying to people, the Pope's wrong, and I can't think of anything more undermining of
Catholic
faith.
If you have
a
Catholic family that already has 9 children and 68 comes along, and then their parish priest are practically telling them, you've already had too many children.
Yeah.
I mean, they went
The other thing is, at the same time, Walter Cronkite is going on the news every night preaching, what's his name?
Ehrlichman? The population bomb.
Yeah. And so they're getting constant, the world is overpopulated, which was always nonsense.
It's bad math, as my friend Alan Carlson has demonstrated.
It was the global warming of the 60s.
Yeah. Right. It was more scientifically certain because it was a math problem. When I was a kid, overpopulation was presented as an absolute scientific certainty in the way global warming is now.
But the
person then is left feeling, my priest and my bishop, they're telling me, just wait, the church will get with the times or whatever. They're giving all these signals. The secular world is saying babies are bad because the world is dying and world war is coming. That's a brutal situation for Catholics to be in.
Terrible.
The fact of today, the population problem is demographic winter.
We have to take a break. We'll take that break and we'll come back. But we celebrate the canonization of Paul VI because what a blessing to the church to have another saint. Right. And even if it was the papacy that made him a saint,
everyone should celebrate that canonization side getting a copy of the best book of 2018.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. This was my book of the year. It's so funny.
It's mine too. And
Todd,
by the way,
Agliaro here.
Catholic Answers has done a lot of fine books, superb books, and Layla Miller's book and Trent's did very well for us.
This is the book you should read.
Yeah, Inseparable.
Right. Yeah. It's
with a foreword by Cardinal Burke.
I think it's a hard sell because people are like, I don't know if I want to read a contraception book. This is a book about being a full human being in the modern world. This is a book full of joy. This is not a book meant to knock you down or – This is a great book. Is it five or six? Now I'm forgetting. Different perspectives.
Yeah, five different or six different.
It's not cranky.
It's not cranky at all. It's a joyful presentation of the fullness of the truth about your sexuality and your life on this planet and after this planet. And I just can't recommend it.
You sound like a Mormon now.
Sigh.
Well, they have a lot of kids.
The bishop, our dear friend, the Bishop of Bismarck, Bishop Kagan, bought a copy of this book for every one of his priests and every one of his seminarians.
Just get the book Inseparable. Look, everything's on sale over at shop.catholic.com. Just get the book Inseparable. You won't be sorry you did.
Make it your New Year's resolution to read it.
Give it to your kids. We will move on with more of the year in review right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Trevor Williams from the Pittsburgh Pirates, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious mystic monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All mystic monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase mystic monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
He was a pope, a saint, and a doctor of the church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
Pope St. Gregory I the Great is one of only four popes honored as the Great. Among his many achievements was sending missionaries across Northern Europe, especially St. Augustine of Canterbury, who brought Christ to the people of England. In a pun, Pope Gregory called the English people angels. He died in 604.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome to back to the Catholic Answers Year in Review program. This hour, joined by our chaplain, Father Hugh Barber, our president, Chris Check, and I am Cy Kellett, your host. And I guess two things have occupied the last half hour. That is there's a confluence of these two things: the canonization of Pope Paul VI, who gave us Humanae Vitae, and it was the 50th anniversary of Humanae Vitae. That therefore we give it a lot of conversation. So I want to go into. Not so much a story as a trend. It's a series of stories, many of them heartbreaking, confusing, frustrating, upsetting. That is maybe the story of the year is this idea that transgenderism now has become dogma. The overlords of the dictatorship of relativism, this is their newest project.
The masters of the universe.
This is mistresses
or whatever they are.
Yeah. Well, actually, they're neither.
That's right. They're on the spectrum.
Right.
I think it's neither men nor women that are responsible for this, but large faces. Yeah. Who
demons.
Indeed. And
well, not necessarily demons. They're just misled, a lot of them. So.
No, well, demons.
No, but demons are whipping up
work.
This.
Oh, yeah.
Right. They prey
actually,
on our weakness.
This is what Paul VI said, by the way.
Yeah.
He said demons.
The lack of belief in demons, I think, is one of the great errors of the modern Christian mind. That to not know who the enemy is, or that there even is an enemy, everything's okay, basically, is very dangerous. But I want to get to. All right, I said it.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm moving on now. I defended belief in demons. That's all.
Okay. I believe that that's a good thing to do.
Okay. Transgenderism is – I don't think you can look at the issue of transgenderism and not see it as just the latest in a long line of attacks, or if you look from the other perspective, of liberations. Okay.
Going back to divorce.
Right. And
yeah, that's probably going back to divorce or even back to the 1920s and the embrace of immodesty and all that.
Well, sure. Yeah,
but bobbed hair and girls that look like boys and boys that look like girls.
Yeah.
No, but the thing there is that once you redefine sexual activity in terms of pleasure simply.
Right, right.
Then it doesn't matter what organ you have.
Right.
What you use to get pleasure. It doesn't matter if you're male or female, because the whole point is just the satisfaction.
Right.
And then it becomes just a question of a certain self-image, you know, and that's what it eventually gets parlayed into this whole thing. And what's very interesting is that Paul VI had to deal with the question of contraception because the council was going to deal with it, and very firmly, there was a schema that would have been a dogmatic constitution on marriage, chastity, and the family, which didn't make it through that first year because the Northern Europeans, all the lovely Belgians and French and Germans and whatnot, who knew better than these crusty old Italians, they booted it out. But it was full of prescient understanding that these old guys from the Roman school who were schooled under Pius XII, who never had an unexpressed thought on any current issue, they covered everything.
Oh.
They covered contraception, they covered same-sex attraction, and they covered gender, as we call it now, affirmation.
What'd
surgery.
You call gender?
General reassignment surgery. Anyway, they covered because that was right. Christine Jorgensen was like the late 50s.
Yeah.
So they knew this stuff was going on, you know. And they covered all of it very, very explicitly. And how helpful it might have been for Paul VI and for the rest of us if the council itself had said these things instead of the very weak affirmation of the values of married love and the confusion about the ends of marriage, which is presented in the council documents.
Right.
It's the traditional teaching is not contradicted, but it's presented in so tepid a way that Paul VI had to kind of come in and kind of fix it. And that's happened repeatedly. And of course, thanks to John Paul II, we got an even more vigorous affirmation of human nature as male and female. And
not just a more
reasons.
Vigorous, but also a more intellectually penetrating, I think.
Right, in terms of his particular style of thought.
Yeah.
Paul VI was still in a kind of traditional scholastic mode and like traditional papal documents. But John Paul II, that's a providential reason why probably things waited until he could confront these issues in terms which are more germane to people formed in a modern way.
Yeah, the Pope could speak to a modern
right.
John Paul II could speak to a modern.
But still, but then you have to say basic and a few things with a whole lot of words. Whereas the older form was,
you say it very
simply.
Is that why encyclicals are so long now?
Right.
Because you got to go around.
Used to be you said it very simply.
As Paul VI did in
Humanitate. You read Pius XI on contraception.
Oh, yeah.
It's like one damning paragraph.
Yep.
It's like
and that's that.
Any,
Casta
canubi. There isn't any, But it would have been helpful because it's interesting to examine those documents. They're not available in the vernacular, but you can get them in Catholic libraries if you read Latin. You can read the schema to the council, the ones that they got originally.
Another reason to know Latin.
That's what John the 23rd thought was going to happen.
St. John the 23rd.
St. John the 23rd. Right. So his image is Jolly John, who was going to allow everybody to do whatever they wanted.
You mean
completely false.
John the 23rd wasn't just Gary Wills in the past? He was a real Catholic.
Right. He was very Catholic, like super Catholic.
But the thing about this transgenderism, to me, it is – somehow even more terrifying. It seems like we've gone to a new and more terrifying level of the sexual revolution. And what is that? I mean, part of it is because I do think a great deal of it involves child abuse, that we're now treating children as these malleable things. And what's really happening is the parents are sick. The parents want an exciting child. And so they're determined that my 5-year-old is transgender. It was a tremendous abuse of children.
Very chic, right.
It's very chic and it's sick and it's violent towards children. And it includes things like giving 12-year-olds – I mean the good guys, according to the narrative, give 12-year-olds
hormone suppression.
Hormones at 12. You know,
that's got to be healthy.
So Father Hugh is the philosopher here, and he correct me if I'm wrong. But Cy, I think that the reason it's more terrifying even than perhaps contraception, from which it comes, by the way, is that it is a more obviously anthropological or ontological terror. It goes right to being what a human person is, right? Would that be a fair way to say it, Father?
I would say, yeah, because God created us in his own image, and then it says male and female, he created them. So that's like it's the – being created in God's image is one thing, and then the next statement is he created the male and female because, of course, human nature, if we're going to have more human beings that are created in God's image, they have to come about –
Yeah.
And so you have to have male and female.
I never thought that would be the part of the Bible that would get challenged, male and female who created them. There's a lot of controversial stuff in there. I never thought that would be the part that would get challenged.
Yeah, just look in the mirror. I mean, we're the ones that are supposed to be unscientific.
Yeah, well, I have to say, Sue, I said it's terrifying, and I know there are people who that's Catholic Church's fear-based morality. Well, there's some things you should be afraid of, like child abuse. Don't do it.
Si, I want to make a public thank you to every priest who speaks candidly and truthfully from the pulpit on these topics.
Amen. We're going to continue our review of the year. We're going to move out of the sexual realm into other things right after this on Catholic Answers Live.